House Judiciary Committee, May 15, 1977, room 350, 12:30 p.m., page 56.
Committee of Public Order, Joseph Lopez, members present, Representative Judith, Chair of Move the House Bill 2614 be taken from the table. Is there any objection? Before us again, Representative Bailey.
Chairman,
I was just going to say, Mary, come up to him. Doesn't come out exactly the same.
Going to take place for a very short period of time, so I have no written testimony, and in fact my testimony shall be very, very brief. I ask you to again consider House Bill 2614, and I know this is a very, very difficult bill. It could have, and I'm sure you're thinking of ramifications in the court setting for those of you who are lawyers or about to be lawyers. But I think I'd remind you of a couple of things. Since time began, children have been considered property, and so have women been considered property of their husbands. And too often, if they're in a situation where they're living with someone, we're beginning to look, do children have any rights? And we're also beginning to look, do women have rights other than the fact that in the eyes of the court they've been considered property of their male spouse? That's really what this bill is all about. And I'd like to say it is a lot more, but in my opinion, it is not. I don't think that snicker, I don't know what the snicker is.
Cooling down, he was just giving another smoking instrument.
Oh. That's really where I'm coming from, and that's why that I introduced this bill, because I think that I don't consider myself property of my husband, and more important, he doesn't consider me property. If I were to assault my husband, I'm sure that I would be in the courtroom faster than I expected. And to me, it's just a situation of how we view assault. This just happens to be a particular kind of assault. Mary has some formal testimony, and I think she has some good points. I appreciate the opportunity. It was just the fact that you're willing to listen once more, and I'm sorry I missed the testimony before.
Yeah, I might say, too, that I think I indicated Mary that our action taking the bill the other day was not for a malicious action. I think we were under the impression that it was the action consistent with the steps that we've taken with respect to the question of the definition of female. And if we were wrong on that, fine, we're more than willing to hold that.
Mr. Chairman, it never crossed my mind that anything this committee would do is malicious.
I know it shows me a long term accused of it.
I know anything she wants before.
Is there anything else you'd like?
No, well, I heard you say around the hall this morning.
Not so, Mr. Chairman.
Before you go on, Mary, I noticed we have some students here today. Where are you from? Well, I'd like to welcome you. Just by way of explanation, we have a bill in the committee that deals with the criminal code in Oregon that we have brought back before us today, having tabled it earlier so that some witnesses could come in and give us reasons why they think it should be passed rather than killed in the committee. So that's the posture of what's before us right now. Our first witness is Representative Burroughs, a member of the House from Eugene, and this is Mary Souther, who is a lobbyist for the just call it Women's Coalition.
Women's Rights Coalition.
Women's Rights Coalition, kind of an amalgamation of a number of different groups, principally interested in women's legislation. Mayor, if you go ahead now.
Okay. For this particular bill, I prepared some written testimony, and I don't know if you have it before you now. There's two pages with an attachment to
a
news article.
No, we don't have it.
I left it over there, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, this is dealing with House Bill 2014, which repeals ORS 163-335, the cohabitation defense to rape. The issues are that a woman has a right not to be raped, number one, and also that rape is a crime, and thirdly that I think the woman and the complaining witness and the alleged rapist should be on an equal footing, and we should do away with the affirmative defense of cohabitation. I'd like to read through my testimony then, please. ORS 163-335 was enacted in 1971 with the revision of the criminal code, but its purpose is not understood, at least for me. This statute treats a woman who is cohabiting with a man if they are legal spouses. This statute prevents an unmarried woman from even bringing the charge of rape against her assailant if she happens to live with him. This statute benefits no one except potential rapists, from my point of view. A woman's decision to live with a man should not be interpreted by law to mean that she consents to sexual intercourse and even rape. A woman may choose to live with a man for economic reasons or for protection. While this law is in effect, she may be in more danger by living with a friend than by risking an assault by a stranger. And if you'll see the attached news article, it says that 1.3 million persons are sharing 660,000 two-person households with an unrelated adult of the opposite sex. And it says that they're not necessarily shacking up, but they may be experimenting with living arrangements before they decide whether they want to marry or not. And also, there are other reasons why people choose to live together. Also, many people find themselves living with people by chance and not by choice, and the arrangement may be difficult or impossible to change. And I've heard of one, and I have experienced personally with a friend of mine, where the house painter or a friend moved possessions into the house, and then it's just one more step, and the person's moved in. And my friend hasn't been able to remove the roommate in 8 months, and it's kind of a scary situation. But that person has threatened violence before. Also, if this were repealed and a person could be charged with rape for sexually assaulting a roommate, perhaps this would be a deterrent to those types of attacks in the future. Since the status of people living together may be difficult to determine except by attorneys, that is, whether the persons are married and living together, married but maintain separate domiciles, married but maintain separate residences, not married and living together, not married or cohabitating, plus other possible arrangements. Wouldn't it be sensible to eliminate obstacles to the charge of rape and just let the woman prove her case in court? This was the position of the Senate Judiciary Committee 2 days ago when they decided to amend Senate Bill 503 to delete the definition of female. And that was the court that was originally decided in here on 2523. And one of the points they made was that rape where people are cohabiting would have to be aggravated enough for the woman to be able to prove that she was raped. And the case would have to be strong enough for her to be willing to go to court on it. And I would maintain that I've read that there are only 1-2% of false charges in rape, and that's no higher than any other false charges in other crimes. Also, relating this to the wife abuse situation, there aren't very many charges brought anyway. And also because the burden of proving when they're cohabiting that there was not consent, I think that there would not be, I don't think that you could predict that there would be a huge increase of rape charges brought if the statute were repealed.
Some people suggest that allowing women to bring a rape charge but not prosecuting would be even more frustrating to women than not allowing them to bring the charge at all. I think this argument lacks logic. If in fact rape cases are not being prosecuted, I think it's the prosecutors that need to be educated. I don't think women should be barred from bringing the charge.
On that point, I kind of take some offense to that, in the sense that I don't think it's the prosecutors that need to be educated, because I think they're more than willing to try to prosecute any case that they think they can win. I think it is society that needs to be educated, and I think that your comment in subsection 5 is not well taken.
Okay, I'm basing that on my experience in Marion County, where the police have really raised their conscious level on rape cases. I think since only one rape trial has been held in Marion County, from my knowledge, in 10 years, that there were 47 rapes this past year, that they do need some education. Also, people may argue that it's not fair to allow a woman cohabiting with a man to bring a rape charge, when they don't allow a woman living with her husband to bring a rape charge. But I don't think the answer to this is to not allow women in either case to bring a charge. I think a single unmarried woman should be able to bring a charge of rape. Whether or not you agree with this position on House Bill 2614, I would urge that you give the bill an opportunity to be heard on the floor. I have reason to believe since April that it has a good likelihood of passing on the floor.
I'm a little frustrated because I think you missed the whole thrust of the argument yesterday. You approached this as in the fact that we were opposed to the concept in the bill. We are not. It was merely a point that the committee thought that by taking care of the one bill on the definition of female, we were also taking care of this other statute. And it wasn't that anybody was disagreeing with you. It was the fact that we thought it was already encompassed in another statute. And I think the problem is, in the chairman looking at it, it appears that you were correct originally, that they are two separate issues. The committee took the action I thought that it did because we thought it was one single issue. And I'm a little offended because the presentation of it is no one's opposed to it that I know of.
I think it was our sense of having disposed of the one in the way we did, that in the amended version or the original version of the stores, that it made this issue redundant, this bill redundant. And I don't think it does. I'm sure you're going to raise a separable question.
Rather than explain our misunderstandings, I need to build in the floor with the detail.
What
was tabled, wasn't it?
It was taken from the floor.
Was
it a discussion?
It was a discussion, yes. What we did yesterday is in the case of a married couple, we said that the action could be maintained basically only if they were separated or maintaining a separate domicile, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what do you do with the situation of an unmarried couple who have been cohabiting, but who are now maintaining a separate domicile or are separated?
They're not married?
They're not married.
Well, she can bring a charge. The district says you can't bring a charge if they're at the time of the rape they're cohabiting together. They would be like separate citizens.
What we're saying, though, is that if you happen to be living together and you're married, we're saying you can't bring the case. And as you say, if we leave this in, we're saying the same thing. If you're unmarried but living together, you likewise cannot bring the case.
Right. If you leave the statute as it is, cohabiting persons cannot be charged.
The same as the married person. With the law that we passed out of here. It seems to me we've got to be consistent. Maybe I'm missing the point, but
And I supported the prior measure.
Right.
You know, so we'd rather have them both go out of here one way or both go out of here the other way.
Well, that's why I didn't understand how these two bills are consistent. I don't think because a woman is denied the right, the woman who's married is denied the right to charge her husband with whom she's living with rape, that a single woman who's cohabitating should also be denied that right.
Just
because you put limits on married women, I don't think you put limits on unmarried women. If that's where you draw the line.
It is possible from a policy point of view to take the one position as to persons who are married and living together, and put a different position as to persons who are unmarried and living together.
I guess the one difference in the bill, and this bill and the other bill, is the fact that your point that in some cases an unmarried woman who's living with someone may not be in a sexual relationship with that person, and that person needs some protection under the law. On the other hand, my problem with the other bill, originally, the way it was drafted, I think still exists with this bill, and I'm much more comfortable with the domicile concept as a whole. That's the practical application rather than the theoretical application that really concerns me. And, I'm in a quandary.
I'm not sure I follow. Because I think one issue is married women and one's unmarried women.
I wonder about if the practical application or if the difficulties are somewhat different or less onerous in the case where two people have not actually solemnized their relationship and are living together in a marital state.
They're less onerous, but I'm still not convinced that that this could not create a difficult problem.
Well,
the same kind of in the other situation.
You mean a practical impediment
right.
to actual prosecution.
Right.
There's anything else?
You know, Mr. Chairman, it's obvious after reading the criminal code and the commentary, and it's what we're doing with this bill is reversing our policy decision in 1971. And in 1971, with the enactment of the criminal code, what Kip said, we were actually trying to be somewhat consistent and treat the married woman the same as we were treating cohabitation the same as a marriage situation. And what we're doing now is we still have the marriage situation, and you're asking us to reverse our policy decision that we established in 71 and said, we're not going to do that anymore, and we don't want you to treat them the same, because they should be distinguished. And the reason, well, if reading the commentary in 71, what they said is because they're changing lifestyles, and people were cohabiting together, and they should be treated the same as marriage. And now you're saying that they shouldn't be.
But who are you protecting?
Well, I'm saying that you're asking for a change in the policy that the legislature established in 71.
Right.
No one's
denying that.
No.
And that's why we introduced the bill. It's because they think it is bad policy. And it seems to me the point is well taken. I agree with Kip. I think the longer you talk about it, the more you prove. You tend to reinforce our original point. There's no reason to not define a married woman as a female under this statute. But at the very least, it seems that there's no reason to deny unmarried women this protection. Now, if the committee in its wisdom decides that married women do not derive this, should not benefit from this policy of protection, that's fine. Hopefully, when we see what happens in the Senate, we might be able to reverse that. But it seems to me, again, no reason to deny a statement of public policy that for whatever proof problems we might encounter, that we ought not at least to, in terms of a statement of public policy, extend this protection against assault to unmarried women.
For the discussion of the motion,
I don't think they didn't understand what the statute meant. And what I was doing was saying that's why the statute was enacted was in 71. That was the policy statement of the legislature. And it's obvious that you're saying we should change it.
Okay, Robinson.
I just want to say that I had thought too that when we took action on the other bill, we solved the issue in this case. I did not see a separate
decision. Are you the second?
Question.
Clerk will call the roll on the motion to
put my motion in place.
Yes, Jim. Question is on the motion to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
How tactically are you going to proceed with it? You're going to wait till 508?
And hold the other bill until I see what happens on the Senate side of that bill.
But this will go ahead.
I see no reason why this shouldn't proceed.
Thank you.
Senate bill passes, we'll act on the other issue and with that vehicle. If it proceeded, I'll file the report on our other bill.
But this will go ahead in anyway.
Yeah, unless the committee sees some problem with it, I think I just assume for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take the 2096 relating to wildlife and commercial fishing law violations. We have representatives from the administration and also from representative buyers' offices in the committee. If you both like to come up, or
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Major Walt Hershey, Oregon State Police Department. I did testify on this bill before. I don't believe all the members were present. There may be some questions. I have very little to add from my original testimony, except that the situation is continuing to worsen, especially in the area of the Columbia River as it relates to illegal gill netting.
Just for the committee's information, case those remarks are not clear to the moon. There was a joint hearing on this bill with the Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Some members of this committee were not able to attend. And in the wake of that meeting, the bill was amended by the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee to anticipate, well, not anticipate, response to concerns some of us have raised about its original application. Representative Lombard.
Isn't there also another bill in Ag and Natural Resources now that deals with punishment for poaching?
This 2096 came out of Ag and Natural Resources, and it was a joint hearing between the two committees.
I remember this one, but somebody wrote me a letter the other day about another one. Where is it? Had to do with not maybe minimum mandatory provisions. Poaching, wasn't it?
The minority report. I believe that we received another bill from your committee on illegal fishing operations.
For the confiscation of nets?
The confiscation of nets. Could that be it?
No.
Okay, maybe as a word of explanation to separate the two issues. First of all, our department felt very strongly about making a Class E felony on as it relates to illegal gill netting in the Columbia River. Frankly, I'll say again today, I don't believe that we will ever be able to discourage it or stop it. It's increasing despite additional effort by our people. But we have a limited amount of staff that we devote all night work on well over 300 miles of the river, spend all our resources there, then we're losing our grip on other valuable resources that need tending to during the daytime. So I'm convinced that we will never be able to control it. We used to think that the bulk, so sort of took care of it, because it took a lot of fish to be worth a little money. Now very few fish are worth a lot of money. You can put $1,000 worth of fish in the trunk of an ordinary sedan, an automobile, and this is happening. Since I testified the last time on this bill, for an example, a load of illegal fish that went into a restaurant, and this was one of the sources, the primary sources where they dispose of them. There's 119 salmon in the round, they were dressed by the time we weighed them, over 1,000 pounds of dressed fish, but this would have represented about 1,500 pounds of fish in the round. The restauranter bought them for $1.50 a pound and freely admitted that he bought them to beat the $2.60 a pound he'd have to pay for legal fish. Out of Portland fish. The incentive is there. And they're anxious to go down and open up the back door in the middle of the night to get these bargain prices on fish. And there's the Washington Game Department, Washington Fishery Department, even the federal authority, since there's some federal hatcheries on the river, have started devoting effort during the night on it as much time as they can spend. And they all these agencies agree completely with me that we're fighting an uphill battle. All right, now this is one issue. Now, I personally would like to have had the two issues separated, the big game animals, and I think we've come close enough to doing that. I didn't think this would be receptive at this time to label killing a deer in close season a Class C felony. So, your chairman, Representative Byers, and several of us had a little discussion on this, and we felt that confining it to two closed seasons. Now, this takes out the emotional things that may happen to somebody in the excitement of the hunt, if that's one way of putting it, in an open season where he's at least legitimately out there. But under this bill now, if he goes out the second time and in closed season, and kills a big game animal, then it would be a Class C felony. The reason that the big game animals are in there was a lot of strong feeling from southern, eastern, central Oregon. Several of our legislators from over there felt strongly about this, and their constituents were putting a lot of pressure on them for it. So that's why we have the two issues in the same bill. I would personally have rather dealt with them separately, but we're happy with it.
Representative Gardner.
I only have one problem with the bill, and that is there's kind of a reverse effect from a practical point of view in court sometimes when you increase penalties or something. We had last session legislation increased the penalty for driving while suspended from Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. As a result, all those prosecutions took place in the circuit court rather than the district court. I was involved in several cases where the person, as a practical result, sure, he's a felon, but he ended up getting probation, maybe a $100 fine, whereas if he was prosecuted under a Class A misdemeanor in district court, he would have probably received a $500 fine and a year in county jail. And the problem is that the circuit court is dealing with rape, robbery, burglary, arson, murder, and then some guy comes in who happens to have gotten gill netted some fish on the river, and that he's kind of lumped in with the rest of them. He says, well, gee, your first appearance, I'm going to give you probation, or even a second offense, 30 day jail sentence. Whereas if he'd been in the district court, he would have been treated a lot more harshly. He really wants it. With that kind of actual practice in the court.
Well, if I may respond to that, this has not exactly been our experience with it. And I'm not being critical of the courts when I say this. Every legal mind is familiar with the Class A misdemeanor and Class C felony. The red flag goes up right away. We've had a lot of cases where they flip right through court, and the judge has the image of the barefoot boy walking down through the dust with a willow pole in his back. One we just had a couple weeks ago. And this was a new judge. I'm not being critical of him. But But people went right in the court and pled guilty. We'd arrested them a couple nights before. We sold their fish for over $600. Caught them with half of the net in the boat, half of it out. Beautiful case. Seized their equipment. They ran into court and were fined $15 apiece. And all the equipment are returned to them. That's in district courts. Now, if there had been an indication of a Class C felony, the legal mind would have gone to work and done a little research before he would have let those people walk out of there with a felony like that.
One last comment. The only difference in my mind, the criminal cases between district court and circuit court, is that the penalty that can be imposed. And here we're talking about, instead of 1 year in the county jail for maximum, we're talking about 5 years in the state penitentiary. And this committee has been involved with corrections matters. We've had the people from the parole board in here talking about the overcrowding in our prisons. And I can't see any judge, even though this may be a very heinous offense in your mind, and it certainly is in mine because I'm a hunter, I still can't see any judge sending someone to the penitentiary for committing this kind of an offense. So for practical matter, I don't see any difference between the Class A misdemeanor and the Class C felony.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, one more example, and the type of person that we're looking at here are the same people that you're talking about referring to there. This being so lucrative has attracted a criminal element. We're not talking about the bona fide commercial fishermen. They don't want to jeopardize their equipment, their livelihood, and they're as anxious to have something done about these people as we are. We have some that we've arrested over 20 times now. Never served a day in jail or paid a meaningful fine. They've been going in and out of the district court. The same people that in their spare time, there's no fish runs, they're stealing. One of them runs a string of girls when he runs out of anything else to do. These are the types of people that we're talking about. They're criminals. Any way you slice them, it isn't. It's just that this is a quick way to make $1,000 a night, so when the fish are running, they're right in the midst of it.
Mark, I don't know if you read it or I read Don Holmes' article in the Northwest magazine this weekend. And it was enough that I had got it flipped out at home right in the office, but it was enough to turn my stomach at what this is the witness is saying and what apparently what district courts have been doing that. Now, I'm not sure that the C Class C felon is the answer. I think that's the minimum mandatory. You know, taking second and third offenses and requiring that
Caroline did most
and just not giving the judge the option to slap them on the wrist, because Holm was relating this incident where the individual was a multiple offense where he'd been in before and got slapped $15 and got all his equipment back. The only issue I think is that Holm at least said in his article that some of those guys are commercial fishermen. And he said some of them who fish validly and honestly during the season, a few of them are also doing it.
That's true. Some of those have been buying license and then they'll fish during the open season too.
I think the most frustrating thing to the public is, and to law enforcement in this particular area, is that apparently the courts don't view this as serious as stealing yours and my property.
I
think your point is well taken. I don't think we're going to really change anything by making this a Class C felony. However, I think the idea of perhaps leaving it a Class A misdemeanor and imposing some mandatory minimum sentences to be served in the county jail, like say maybe 60 days for the first offense, 6 months for the second, and a year for the third and subsequent offenses.
And why?
Not a bad idea for the that may have some merit. And at that point, when there's a finding of guilt, the judge has to impose that sentence, and he's going to be able to treat it as a $15 fine. But I don't think you're going to have any greater effect on these people if you make it a Class C felony and move it up into circuit court for the very problem that you have now in district court. That's just a personal remark.
Sure, quite frankly, prefers not to attempt to rewrite the bill at this point, but perhaps maybe inclination to pass it to see what the experience is with it. I'm willing to go for it, but Chair moves the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Question.
Clerk, call the roll.
Gilmore.
Aye.
Gilmore.
Aye.
Von Dawson.
Aye.
Conway.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Gordon.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Bowers will format the bill. Yeah, no. I had told him earlier if it came out that he was giving that citizen.
Chairman, can the committee clerk have a copy of that article made?
I'll make a copy of it, yeah.
Yeah, sure, yes,
it'll inflame you. That's very well.
Want something in the file.
The old mandatory minimum on just on a different scale.
Right, yeah. I think it's got some merit.
I think it has some merit in the misdemeanor area. That, not necessarily, a jail on a first offense, but first offense leaves up to the court for the second offense to make a mandatory fine of $500 or something like that, and no ifs, ands, or buts.
That's going to be.
Can't create hardship. Just think about it before you go.
House Bill 2243.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2243 was heard by Subcommittee on March 9th and April 7th. The bill would repeal ORS 206.340, which provides, quote, a sheriff or any sheriff's officer is prohibited during his continuance in office from acting or having a partner who acts as an attorney. The bill was supported by a sheriff's officer from Portland who has gone to law school and now acts as a legal advisor to the sheriff's office. As a lawyer, he must forfeit fringe benefits available to all sheriff's officers unless this bill passes. The bill was opposed by most of the sheriffs outside Multnomah County unless the bill is amended to apply not only to Multnomah County. The subcommittee spent quite a bit of time on this bill and came out firmly opposed to the bill and recommended it to table.
The subcommittee's recommendation will be a motion to table. The clerk will call the roll.
No.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Earl, I finally concluded you're running for sheriff. We don't elect the sheriff anymore.
We eliminated that.
We do, but I'm still working on it.
I went to school with it.
2674.
Okay, Earl. Got one on me, Ted.
Okay.
What number?
2674.
Earl, more than one.
Nope, just one.
The last bill file, I believe. They're in the same order.
I don't see notice of a few.
Most of the bills are the first page, either the last one or the one that's new. 2674,
Mr. Chairman, this bill was sponsored by Representative Kulongowski at the request of John Tenfold from Lane County, and it would remove the required waiting period between the date of application for it and issuance of a marriage budget. It was heard before Subcommittee A on May 3rd, and the testimony at that time by Mr. Tenfold and by him on behalf of others, I guess all the, what's his job?
He's the Director of Elections.
He's the Director of General Services. He says that all of his counterparts around the state support this. Their testimony was that there is no useful service being served by the service.
I'm opposed to the bill. I think we have a naive cooling off period of labor dispute. We have a 90-day waiting period of divorces to determine whether people should perhaps, get back together. And I can't see why there shouldn't be a waiting period, at least some time for contemplation before entering into the state of matrimony.
Okay.
I would like to
support to Representative Gardner in that. I've sat there many times in my office and had people tell me they wish the heck that the filing fees and divorces were marriages were $400 or $500 instead of the other way around. The period was longer, that somehow it had been more difficult than that. Frankly, I think that a 3-day period is not inappropriate.
I agree. Okay. So, motion table. This is the vote for me. Vote for the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
No.
Aye. Richard?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. The marriage fees and the waiting period?
Tell them what's left,
no time.
$2,652. $2,652.
Chairman, I was going to pass around a booklet that was left in the committee. Part of consideration of this bill. This bill was heard on May 3rd by Subcommittee A. Again, it was sponsored by Representative Kulongowski. At the request of Mr. Davis, the issue in this bill is that although it's illegal to own gambling devices in this state, there are certain antique gambling devices that are not used for gambling anymore. They're collector's items, and Mr. Davis apparently collects them regardless of the statute, but to be authorized under the statute to continue this hobby.
I had the privilege to sit on the subcommittee. I wonder if Representative Kulongowski's is there any threat of prosecution? Are they being for having a red top lifting machine or something like this?
I think the problem is what he told me. If he's ever been down on Highway 38, Darlene, he tried to put him into a store as he's got clocks all around, and he tried to put all these things in there, and allegedly he's been told he can't do it. Now, we may be able to resolve this thing very quickly. The bill has a subsequent referral. If I'm not mistaken, it has a subsequent referral through revenue. And if the chairman of the revenue would indicate to us what type of action that this bill can be.
The chairman of the revenue committee would move to rescind this subsequent referral.
Revenue and School Finance Committee. We'll take those issues separately. That'll be a motion to amend.
My vote on one is contingent on the other.
The question is on the motion to amend. Any motion by adding a recommendation that the subsequent referral be rescinded.
Just a second. I want to read the paragraph 2 pretty carefully here before we vote. Thank you. I have a question to staff. Maybe I'm not reading it carefully, but is there any possibility of the antique gambling device being operated for the purposes of gambling and yet not being in the possession of the defendant, and there being able to be a defense raised under this section in the wording?
Questions on the motion to amend the main motion by recommending that the subsequent referral be rescinded. Clerk will call roll.
Aye.
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 No.
No. Further discussion on the main motion?
Did it pass?
Yeah. Pardon?
Did that motion get passed then?
Yeah.
Aye.
Further discussion on the main motion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Gardner has something he wants to say before we take.
Well, we'll think you will call him.
Aye.
Gardner?
No.
No.
The bill comes for us?
No, the bill's gone.
I'd move to amend the bill, line 16 on section 1, sub 3, delete the language after gambling while in the defendant's possession. Put a period after gambling.
What's that, Will?
Line 16 of section 1, page 2.
Okay.
And your amendment would delete the language while in the defendant's possession.
That's fine. Good amendment.
Mr. Chairman? Can I ask an explanation of the import of that amendment?
Well,
the reason I voted against the bill is because I wasn't sure that the language wasn't so ambiguous. There might be a defense that would be able to be raised in the case where the antique device was used for gambling, but was not technically in the defendant's possession. And just deleting that language makes it less ambiguous to me, and I think it can support the bill.
Yeah. Well, one thing also might be, this is set up as an affirmative defense, and it's set up as a defense possession of a gambling device. And so I think really the language is the first one, because the charge in the first place is going to be you possessed or you didn't possess. And that's the principal element of the crime in the first place. That you don't even have to, if you didn't possess it, you don't even have to raise this affirmative defense. You just say, I didn't possess it.
Well, I'm just...
Don't you think in reading that...
I'm happy with the language.
Yeah, I Further discussion of amendments? Is there any objection to amendments? Further discussion of the bill?
Mr. Chairman. I would move further amend the bill in line 15 after the words antique slot machine or gambling device and add the word was not operable and strike the balance of the sentence.
Well,
the thing is that
I think part of the antique nature of it is the thing that it's still functional. It still functions.
It's got money in it.
But I mean, if I understood his testimony.
No, I'm not talking about breaking. I'm saying simply remove and put in safekeeping an essential component so you don't destroy its antique value, but you don't create any suspicion that it could be used during the off hours or whatever.
They're saying about the same thing as having an antique music box and making it unoperable. You know, the value in it for people collecting things is in the preservation of it, not only in the collection, but in the preservation as well.
Is it a question of the amendment? Clerk, call the roll on the amendment.
Governor?
No.
Governor?
Aye.
Governor?
Kendall?
No.
Mama?
No.
Rupert?
No.
Gardner?
No.
Smiles?
No. Fail.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. Representative Lewandowski moves the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a recommendation to the Rules Committee of the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue in December. Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
No.
Lewandowski?
Aye.
Mama?
Aye.
This is the only representative Stephen Gatsby's role.
Oh, yeah. What's the
number?
26,
can I just say for a moment how I got
this 27 years?
This bill was heard by Subcommittee D on March 9th and April 7th. The bill would amend ORS 10.150, which requires the county clerk to compile a jury list which contains the following information. The Christian name, the surname, the place of residence, and the occupation of the suspected jurors. The testimony we heard was that the information for a jury list is gathered from the voter registration card, and that these cards do not specify occupation. Therefore, the county clerk is unable to meet the terms of the law. There's no way for him to obtain the information he needs to file a list. The deal would delete the requirement that the jury list contains the occupation. The subcommittee recommended that the bill be passed and recommended a further deletion of the word Christian, referring to Christian name on line 5. It was recommended that the word Christian be deleted and the word clerk be inserted.
And the word what be inserted?
First name. So it would be first name rather than Christian name.
Mr. McGregor.
I move the adoption of the amendment to support this cap.
Further discussion? The amendment moves to substitute first for Christian on line 5. That's the only amendment. Further discussion? No objection? Further discussion on the bill as amended? That's going to get reached. Subsequent recommendation will be a motion before it. Further discussion? Question is on the motion to send the bill to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Subsequent
recommendation.
Do you want to amend surname, last name? I recall we discussed that and rejected it for some reason. Yeah. Bill had two hearings, they must have been talking about something. Must have been that issue.
I assume you don't want that amendment then? Okay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye.
Gentlemen, this bill is heard. You just realized
Chairman, House Bill 2727 was heard by the full committee on March 28th. It's a very technical bill. It permits corrections officers who act as court guards to carry concealed weapons without a permit. It applies only to Multnomah County, which has it uses corrections officers rather than sheriffs.
Term corrections officers defined in the
Oh, wait a second. We have proposed amendments to this bill too. And I believe the, although my name's been clear, I believe the committee favorably considered the proposed amendments that we've gotten forward.
Let's take the look at the proposed amendments first. There's a separate set of proposed amendments. Is that the one you're referring to?
Right.
The subcommittee recommendation, right?
Well, it was moved before the full committee, and there is, I have no indication that the full committee took a position, but my memory is that they did favorably consider without actually taking a vote.
Tightened up the presence officers while they're acting within the scope of their employment so that they're off duty training until whether they have no business in the courthouse. Well, now, while acting within the scope of employment, is that intended to modify the entire section?
No, it adds a new section. Apparently, I realize what happened is that they came in and said not only did this section need to be amended, that is to say 156-260, but also 156-370, in their opinion, needed to be amended so that they could lawfully carry their concealed weapons in Multnomah County Courthouse.
Okay, the motion to adopt the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Romano.
Would the amendment to section 2, subparagraph 2A, require that the sheriff, policeman, or other duly appointed police officers also be acting within the scope of their employment?
Well, that was my question a moment ago, whether that would modify the entire section, and I believe it's the intention of the amendment, which I think we should make clear in our own record, is we agree that that modification only goes to corrections officers. The present exception in 166370 for sheriff, policemen, or other duly appointed peace officers, well, it has no modification. Is there a definition of a corrections officer there?
I can't remember.
The only thing
I'll try to find
is,
I believe there is, but I
just
don't know.
Anyone here from Multnomah County?
Mark Kelly, City of Portland.
I think there is, but I might just find it.
Mr. Chairman, can we set this over until we find out the definition rather than holding?
Well, I hate to drag you both back down. I think our inclination is probably to act. I think it's an inclination to act favorably on the bill, but I think we've got a concern here about the precise wording, at least as proposed by the amendment. I mean, there's a way we could look at it.
So I'm a little reluctant to see that
policies throughout the state. And recognizing the county's cause, I'm wondering if there would be some sentiment to limit to Multnomah County. I don't know how others feel. I'd like to raise that question.
Comment on the committee? Is it all known?
As I understand the situation in Multnomah County, the distinction between sheriff's officers and corrections officers, and corrections officers don't feel presently have the authority to carry the weapon. Is that right? That's a clear recollection.
That's right.
Good.
Right. I
don't know that really it's really going to affect any of the counties, other than possibly if some of the other home rule counties have that kind of a breakdown, because Jackson County, for instance, they're only sheriff officers. They are the.
Well, I thought that they were corrections officers. They work for the corrections division. No, not on the contract. Well, you're right. Those are corrections officers.
Those are corrections officers. Although a county, I'm sure, has its corrections officers, but in Jackson County, for instance, they're all
corrections officers. Well, just in Lane County, they do it a little differently because the corrections officers are with the jail. And if there's any inmate that's being transported to the courthouse, it's done by the sheriff. And the corrections officers, in fact, do not go in and handle the prisoners once they leave the area of the jail. Now, I take it in Multnomah County, they do it differently because the corrections officers actually bring the inmates over to the courthouse that actually have to sit behind them during the trial and everything. But in Lane County, you'd have the corrections officers being given a right which they don't exercise because they never take the inmates to jail. I mean, to the courthouse.
Do they not take them to jail because they can't carry a weapon, or do they not take them to jail because the sheriff wants to?
It's just the sheriff does it.
Personally, the sheriff.
I'm wondering, Ross, if I may ask Dennis Keith, I'm wondering if there's any reason why that reference to while acting within the scope of employment shouldn't be narrowed to track with the language under 166260. There's any reason for a reference that broad, if you can see. The other language would read, corrections officer while transporting or accompanying an individual convicted of or arrested for an offense and confined in a place of incarceration or detention.
Aye.
2665.
No, I'm a guest on that.
Robert Cox, Portland Police Bureau, and also in the audience is Sergeant Noble Keith with Multnomah County and Special Agent Dar Holm, who is with the National Auto Theft Bureau. We've had a hearing on this bill. We have a set of amendments that we'd like to submit to you for your consideration that have been done in conjunction with speaking with the Department of Motor Vehicles and with the licensed auto records.
I do have a copy of those.
Line four about an appropriate place on the component of the vehicle.
to be read into this amendment as was stated. This would allow the appropriate place to be ascertained and utilized rather than the old form that motor vehicles would send a letter out and say, take it to your friendly garage mechanic and have him stamp it somewhere conveniently on the frame. Nobody would know where it was, and sign it off and send it back, and they'll accept that it's been done. Having done that, of course, if this was a type of or group of people that we are intending to go after, in other words, the thieves, you at that time were sending this letter out and having this done right to the same group, they'd stamp their own number and send it back on their own, and it accomplished nothing. This way it either has the division do it or the police agency holding the property before sending it back or giving it back to a legitimate person so it can be removed from them again.
Chair moves the adoption of the amendment. Mr. Walmart.
I might just suggest from a linguistic point of view, I haven't finished counting the number of words in the sentence, but it's, I believe it would be within a few sentences and made more readable. The way the amendment is proposed is if you put a number and then put after that, the number shall be affixed on, the V number shall be affixed on an appropriate place in the vehicle.
Sure, we'll include in this motion the separation of the full sentence into two. Dennis can prepare that amendment accordingly. Further discussion of the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Further discussion of the bill as amended? Dennis?
On page 6, my notes from the hearing indicate that on line 5, 4 and 5, there's reference to manufacturer's vehicle identification number, and then in the margin I attempted in, or other identifying numbers assigned by the division or the police or whatever single line is consistent. I want to say that as an issue. That's something that you meant to address.
What's the line again on page 6?
Page 6, lines 4 and 5. The end of 4 is the end of 5. There's a penalty imposed from removing the manufacturer's vehicle number. But I'm wondering whether there shouldn't be a similar reference to the numbers that you're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, in my original testimony on the fourth page of my notes that I submitted to the committee, I did have such an amendment, and it's an oversight on my part that they were not included in this new amendment. The reason for this is that we not only want it illegal for a thief or a group of people to remove the manufacturer's serial number, but we also, once having had it renumbered by the Motor Vehicle Division, want the removal of that number.
Chair moves that the bill be further amended, page 6, line 5, after the word number, by including the following additional words, or identification number assigned to the vehicle or component thereof by the division.
Correct.
Okay. Further discussion amendment? Any objection amendment? That kind of change has to be made anywhere else.
Mr. Chairman, to incorporate into the motion that any other similar question language be inserted.
It'll be taken in that sense.
All right.
Is anything?
I have on my margin at line 30 on page 6 redundant. I think that came out
a little bit from the Department of Motor Vehicles testimony.
Chairman, that addresses itself to the boat. page 6.
I'm sorry, page 3, excuse me. Well, I may be probably a different reference, but let me pick up mine for just a moment if I may. There's a reference in the DMV testimony, page 3, section 6, beginning at line 29. Has your amendment taken care of that?
That's what it was intended to do, Mr. Chairman. That amendment that we gave you for deletions of lines 33 through 35 and deleting lines 1
yeah,
through 4
okay.
being in the page.
I started reading the DMV portion just now, so again, okay. Yeah. Further discussion? Representative Sulongoski?
Just as my understanding, there's nothing in this bill that's going to give a police agency the authority to specifically search a vehicle for alterations or anything like that, is there?
No, sir. The,
it's only once the vehicle is in your possession.
We have a rightful possession or rightfully to be able to look at, in the window and see the vehicle with identification number.
Well, what I want to make sure of is that you don't go, it isn't that you can go out and stop a vehicle and then make a complete search of the vehicle on the pretense of seeing that the motor vehicle number's been altered or something like that.
There was no intent, and I don't read that anywhere in this bill.
I just want to make sure of that.
Any questions? Chair would move the bill to the floor as amended with a B-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Vote for call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. 2853.
Chairman, 2853 is a bill dealing with legal fees incurred in legal action brought to determine whether the bill is extreme. Representative Rogers' bill was heard by Subcommittee C on May 2nd. And there are proposed amendments to the bill in your folders. I don't have very many comments. I guess I've
no amendments in the folders.
But I don't
know what's going on. Well, let's go off topic and then we'll come back to it. 29-19.
Full-time as police officers on Indian reservations.
We just found our definition of corrections off.
Well, it's defined in more than one place. I think it came out of that hearing.
You might just, from the full committee, give us a one sentence recap of where such officers now stand.
Such officers are authorized under tribal and federal law. This bill would allow them to participate in state training courses as a law enforcement officer by defining tribal law enforcement agencies as law enforcement units. The reason for doing that, if I can just complete that, is that tribal officers do enforce state law on the reservations and participate quite closely with local law enforcement agencies in their area.
Would
this bill give jurisdiction to tribal police officers to enforce the law, make arrests, etc., off the reservation by virtue of giving them enhanced or granting enhanced status?
No, it would not.
So it would only apply within the tribal jurisdiction and under the tribal and federal law regulating the criminal law within the jurisdiction.
It doesn't do anything one way or the other to the jurisdiction of the tribal police. It only authorizes them to participate in state training courses.
Not retirement.
Correct.
Not retirement.
Not retirement. Just strict state training standards.
Do they now have the power of search and seizure and arrest equivalent to those of a police officer in a metropolitan city?
Yes. They have full law enforcement authority on the reservation.
Chair moves to adopt the amendment. Any objections? Further discussion of the bill as amended?
Move House Bill 2919
is amended to the floor for the D-PASS
recommendation.
Further discussion? Clerk will call the
roll.
Aye.
Lewandowski.
Aye.
Lombard.
Aye.
Wilson.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye. 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 Let's take one more and then we'll recess. We'll come back. 3023.
Okay. That's
the
recess
that we were talking about. Yeah. With the forum. Yeah. We're almost there anyway, I think. Okay.
3023. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, this bill, introduced by Representative Magruder, was heard by Subcommittee A on May 3rd. No one appears either on behalf of or against the bill. The bill would change the requirement of law that now provides you have to have two county surveyors. If a person wants to use evidence of a survey in certain civil action in court, this would allow a person to use a county surveyor or his deputy or a registered professional land surveyor or for a registered professional land surveyor.
My only concern is that it's obvious that this section is probably used in combination cases quite a lot. And I'm concerned if the Attorney General's office has been aware of this at all or seen it. Because I know they've got one whole section over there that does nothing to handle these things. And I don't know what this does to the law of evidence as far as they're concerned.
And no one appears, not even from me.
Could I ask the chairman that this bill be sent to the Attorney General's office to get his assessment of it, of the evidentiary impact on it? I just had Paul. I don't understand it very quickly.
Okay, it'll be sent over. Meantime, why don't we table it? We'll take it off the table if the information looks like it's a proper bill before there's no one appeared on it.
I move the table house, please.
Clerk, call the roll.
Come on.
Aye.
Lewandowski.
Aye. Appropriate point for quick recess. I would like to push on and try to finish the rest. Meeting will return to order. House Bill 3028. We'll come back to the navigable streams bill in a moment.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3028 is another one of the bills introduced and sponsored by Representative Magruder. It was heard by Subcommittee A on May 11th. No witness appeared.
Still needs to go to the table. Quick call away.
Aye.
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 Johnson.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye.
Chairman, 3099 is a bill, the Judiciary Committee bill, introduced in the request of the Speaker. If the bill would allow the court to award full attorney fees to the prevailing party and a suitor action unless the attorney awarded attorney fees for the suitor action is specifically disallowed by law. It was heard by Subcommittee A on May 11th
at my old house.
If there was a move to the table, of course, the call will roll.
Omar.
Aye.
Omar.
Aye.
Wilson.
Aye.
Gardner.
No.
Meyer.
Aye.
No.
Okay.
Okay.
No.
3100.
Chairman, House Bill 3100. Was heard by Subcommittee B on May 4th. No witness appeared. This bill would prevent the use of law enforcement agencies, written policies, procedures, or rules, or guidelines as evidence of negligence actions other than in disciplinary proceedings between the agency and its employees. The Judiciary Committee bill, and again, no witness appeared.
3100. Move
the table, House Bill
3100.
Okay.
Aye.
Omar.
Aye.
Lester.
Aye.
Gardner.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye. 3104.
Chairman, House Bill 3104 was heard by Subcommittee A on March 18th and again by Subcommittee A on May 11th. Very generous because no witness appeared at either of those hearings, but by the end of the bill.
Move the table, Mr. Chairman.
Close the call to roll.
Omar.
Aye.
Omar.
Aye.
What's
the? Do I have a number? 3104.
If
you want some. 3104.
Who happened?
Aye. I don't remember.
Aye.
Aye. Table.
3117. This bill was sponsored by Representative Whalen. It would remove the authority of the court to grant judgment, notwithstanding verdicts in those cases in which directed verdicts could have been granted. It was heard before Subcommittee A on the
11th. No. I the baby table. I bet I could tell you who Edward Lane to argue is. He's a man who died. And the first will call it all.
Aye.
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 I think that's the
point
of the Golden
Goblet. Yeah, separate that out.
Look at that. And we just sent with a due pass recommendation before House Bill 3117.
Did you send
that one out?
You're carrying
me.
Yeah,
you're
carrying
it. You know, Mr. Chairman, I look forward to the legislative waiver. That gentleman came to my office
and explain the whole lawsuit to.
Possible thing, so
you know, I don't
even know.
If you
listen,
you
know,
that's
the thing.
He was having final position of
39-9.
There's a 41 vote for Davis. I voted no.
You tell it over here.
You didn't see it out.
I'd be happy to vote on that, help you dispose of it.
The chair moves the House for 39-9 to table. The court is calling the roll.
Wait, what are you talking about?
The chair is seizing all of this.
Aye.
Stormer?
No. If you heard aye, the chair is going to tell you. Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye. No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Mr. Bowden,
I'm going to go to the prison call.
Aye.
81-86.
Yeah.
81-86. I believe this is a bill that's up for a film I had an issue.
This bill, 3186, is heard by Subcommittee C on May 7th. The Subcommittee recommended that it do pass. The bill would authorize the state and trustee to administer their charitable trust in conformity with laws prohibiting donations.
The recommendation would be a motion to send the bill to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Let's call it all.
With respect to this bill, I should have made a statement before you took the vote, but I would like to let legislative history to reflect two things. Number one, this is designed to permit deviation from the trust without necessarily requiring the trustee to go to court. The very purpose of this bill is to avoid the necessity for the application of free trade doctrine and to have a legislative declaration that it is permissible to administer trust ignoring those discriminatory provisions, and I would like the record to show if any member of the committee disagrees with that construction of the bill.
Okay.
So
I would like unanimous consent to first call my name on the bill.
Yeah.
I would.
Representative Luminara, how do you vote on that bill?
I would have voted aye.
Representative Luminara would be standing voting aye.
I've got a question, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cromart. I'm just wondering, Dave, if you feel comfortable that any trustee, such as the Bellinger, likewise, will simply accept what we're saying here as a matter of legislative record. My problem in the past is that the banks are trustees under something like this, and they're administering it for.
And of course, the Attorney General typically has been the visitor for.
Do you think it's an attorney general's opinion? We have now a legislative council amendment dated 2877 that have been distributed to members. Would you like to recap the testimony on this bill, if you have?
The bill, as drafted, would have allows or requires the state to pay attorney's fees for any of the parties concerned in suits brought to determine and navigability of the freedom of the state. The concept behind the bill arose out of the controversy over the Mackenzie, and that would seem to be a pretty broad remedy to a narrow problem, and so the redrafted amendment is so narrowly focused that attorney's fees, the testimony was that attorney's fees would only be paid to those parties involved in the proceeding with regard to the navigability of the Mackenzie when that suit is finally resolved.
Is this all a question of four of the ways you mean?
I don't know off on that.
Okay, this one, I'd say.
This isn't limited. It's trying to fit a McKenzie prison.
No.
Was that deliberate, Mr. Cox?
Yes, it was.
Deliberate not to mention the Mackenzie River.
That's correct, but
it has no subsequent result.
Representative Gardner?
I don't know, I'm a little concerned about the effect on the signatures here and the statement that proposed legislation would encourage the filing of a large number of cases which might not otherwise arise. I think I'm going to oppose the bill, and I think at this time I'd make a motion to table.
But we're going to need to table House Bill 2853. Cox, do you have any comments? Is this something the division has been pushing?
The division has agreed with Representative Rogers and the Attorney General's office that if the issue needed to be tried for a statewide issue, that the state could reasonably support both sides, attorney fees on both sides, so that this one segment of a population doesn't afford, in a sense, pay for a statewide problem. Now, there is another set of amendments, Mr. Chairman, which I don't know since I came in the middle of this. It was there were two sets of amendments handed to you by Representative Rogers and myself. One was the Legislative Council amendment, and the other one was the suggestion of Donald Morgan, which I thought was put more discretion on the type of lawsuit and the need of bringing a lawsuit in the state land board.
Those
are
the ones you're supposed to use
them. As I understand it, that was the ones that you were supposed to use when you were just presented. And the Attorney General then wrote you a note asking for a limitation on the amount to be spent in any case, so that it wouldn't, in essence, be a free opportunity for an attorney to earn a living for a number of years.
I ask you to withdraw your motion for a moment. Does the committee have Morgan's amendment?
Well, it has been before when you heard the bill, but it's gone.
I said it's Morgan's amendment, yeah.
Well,
David, I keep that home very for
that.
While
we're discussing the amendments, I think there's a question we have to answer, and I think it's getting to Representative Gardner's withdrawal motion that even if the bill passes, it should send it to the floor.
No, it would be my sense that it should have a substantial motion.
Regardless of what series of amendments we pick up.
Yeah. We're talking about he knows how much money that's going to
be.
Representative Fenwell?
I don't think the fiscal impact would be as great as committee members might think, but in any event, on the merits of this bill, the notion that the state can come down on people who think that for 118 years they have owned some property, the state brings a lawsuit which will cost them just a pile of dough to say that the state owns that land, irrespective of whether the state wins or not, it's that kind of involuntary compulsion to go to court that I think is really unfair, and since the suit is being litigated in terms of the interest of the state of Oregon, I don't see why we should compel those people to pay. If they initiate the suit, that's something else, but where they're involuntarily defendants, in a suit that's a legacy for the public interest, I really think that there's a lot of merit.
I agree. Mr. Chairman.
Further,
I consider the statements that have been made, but it seems to me that there's not that great. I asked Mr. Cotton if there is really a fiscal problem with this. Would this require a supplemental appropriation? Would it simply be taken from the fees generated, money generated by the management of state land? So that it would just actually be a reduction of the earnings on state land.
At the present time, there's another issue here, and I don't think it was addressed, and it was kind of left to the committee. Right at the present time, it would be taken from the earnings of the common school fund if it comes, since we're the managing unit, and it would come out of our budget.
It would not require a supplemental appropriation. It would be an offset to earnings. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so there is no reason for us to refer it to Ways and Means because they're not planning on, they don't have a budget of that nature that would require a specific authorization.
Mr. Chairman, then if I point out that there was some talk, and I don't know, of general funding, and since the issues that are involved here are beyond the scope of the common school fund. But if you put it into the common school fund, then the attorney general's request to put some sort of limit on the amount of money to be paid out so we don't invite every attorney to challenge us on the issue of navigability. Because in the case of the McKenzie, as an example, there are 37 miles of stream involved, and you know, perhaps several hundred property owners. And potentially each lawsuit is confined, unless it's done on a mass basis, which we're working on in McKenzie, each lawsuit is confined to the area of the individual property owner. And so therefore you could have a chain effect of from property owner to property owner to property owner. And this is what the limitation and the very careful wording of the law was designed to prevent. So we only tried the issue once. And that's at the appropriate spot, so we determine everything below it.
To the amendments that you were talking about, did they accomplish that objective?
They're being copied again now, so I'm going to answer the question. We'll have a text in a minute.
The amendment that's proposed by the attorney for the other side, it's Mr. Morgan, really, is representing the McKenzie River property owners, and I agreed to, as I understood Representative Rogers in front of the subcommittee, would leave the discretion in the state land board on whether or not the suit would be filed. So they could, in essence, say, we filed this once, we have the issue, we're not going to file it again on every succeeding property owner. And that was the way they chose to handle that issue.
Mm-hmm. Under the present law, does the property owner have a right to bring suit against the state and have the state be the party defendant in that matter?
I would say you're more accustomed to practicing law than I am from this side of the fence, but I would say yes, they need to be clouded.
Would attorney fees be given in that case?
The I'll leave that to your comments. I think the attorney fees might be given if the court so judged, if the property owner won. Isn't that a super fine
Okay. Let me ask you. Under this bill, if the landowner initiated the suit, would this bill allow attorney fees to be given to him?
Well, you would have to read the amendment, but if the landowner initiated the suit, they'd have to have agreement with the land board before the attorney fees would be given.
Does it require the land board to enter into an agreement with the attorney, with the landowner?
If I read the bill correctly, it does not.
So this bill, this bill, the only attorney fee provision that it's talking about is when the land board brings the lawsuit.
Is that in the amendments that we don't have?
Yeah.
The rules that read.
That's something like that. Yeah, those are in the.
Yeah, I agree.
It's more than amendments.
Something else.
The board.
Is it possible to address the issue of setting a limit even without having amendments on while you're waiting for those to come in with dollar limits on the fees?
The limits, they don't include it. They don't include it close enough to the blow.
No, they don't even include that. I'd have to insert
something. We have a separate letter from the Attorney General that was submitted to the subcommittee requesting that there be a dollar limit on it.
I'm reading from the Attorney General's letter. I recommend that a dollar limitation be imposed. It should be $3,500 at the trial level and no more than $5,000 for all litigation levels, including appellate review.
How much for the trial level?
$3,500 for the trial and no more than $5,000 for everything.
Is that just the attorney fees? That doesn't include cost.
Well,
$5,000. Evaluated the question of whether it's regarded to be reasonable as a law?
No, Mr. Chairman, we have not. The division, we depended upon the Attorney General in a way for the expertise there and not. Our own experience in going to the United States Supreme Court was what we want to avoid in the future, where hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent, but we felt very unnecessarily proving that the Willamette River at Corvallis was a navigable stream, which has already been accepted and proved for a number of cases, and this type of thing, where we were dotting every T and crossing every I all the way along. Mr. Chairman, I also met and passed it to the committee that a lot of the original research was not granted as part of the defendant's concern. It might not be adequate, and you might want to do it over again. We make a very comprehensive study of the river before the declaration is made, including the documentation and the historical documents involved. So a lot of the original research has been done ahead of time to begin with. And I can please offer and the committee this.
Thank you. We'll make a part of it.
I did my first proposal.
Oh,
I'll bring another one if you ask me for it.
New bill.
What's this for, Lou?
The new adoption of these amendments.
together with a limitation on the total expenditure to $50,000 that can be able to make it important.
Well, I think the amount better be stated more broadly in terms of appeal rather than if it's form.
I didn't expect the form to say $50,000, not to exceed $50,000.
Mr. Chairman,
what's the word there?
It seems to me that we would be better to leave the amount to the discretion of the landlord. We're giving him power of these amendments anyway. To make the decision as to whether or not they're going to pay the fee. And I think there might be more readily grant fees if they had a discretion to over the amount and not lock them in to any specific
question.
You
know, this is the power of the question.
But I'm talking about the board having a discretion as to whether I'm going to pay the fees at all.
Okay.
And I would suggest that any limitation by the same token of the amount that is going to be paid at any particular level, be with the discretion of the land board acting in the interest of resolving this public policy question in the interest of the thing you couldn't address these amendments to, because these amendments are important to us.
The vision is set the outer limit.
Yeah.
I think it's the court would then have the fee. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that the land board, would decide what, if any, limits they're going to put on the amount of fees that they will reimburse.
I understand that. And do you then permit the court to keep their eyes ceiling and set perhaps a lesser amount? Or is that automatically?
I would imagine so.
The board, okay, I'm just trying to tell you, if that figure becomes the maximum, then the court makes an award ultimately.
I would not think so. That would be not my intent.
Let me suggest another way. Just by way of suggestion, you could look at this. Couldn't you just leave the issue of fees silent and figure that the, in order for the board's investment decision as to whether or not it's going to take fees, would on its own, prior to making that decision, find out what they would see, something on the way of a plea bargain, find out what the bargain would be before you go to the judge. How else could the board make the decision to pay the fees if it didn't, well, could it be set a limit? Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable with giving the land board the power to control the direction of the defendant's lawsuit.
Yeah.
In essence, what you're doing by limiting the bill, I think there ought to be a fixed sum, and if they see that, then they're back on their own hook. But I hate to see the Attorney General's office in there negotiating with the defense about how to limit their strategy so that they can stay within.
Yeah. Let's get that over with. The homeowner needs to adopt the amendment to 513.77 prepared by Morgan, and who was making the inclusion of a limit in the total amount of the penalty fees that may be awarded. I guess you'd be talking about any similar proceeding that we have. To how much for $50,000?
$50,000.
Okay, Danny.
I'm going to vote against this. And if you look at the amendment, it reads section 2, section subsection 3 of section 2. You'll find that in subsection 3 we have a novel situation in the law as far as, it's not novel, but it's almost novel, as far as awarding penalties. And it can be awarded whether or not the termination of navigability by the division is a firm, modified, or reversed. You're just going to, per se, grant, no matter what the outcome of the lawsuit is, the penalty. Then if you look at subsection 2, the board is determining, or the organization is determining whether or not they're going to grant the attorney's fees in the case of a suit being filed. And I just feel very uncomfortable with even with the land board being constituted by the public officials that are on the board, with making that kind of determination as far as attorney fees and this kind of suit. It almost, in a sense, almost becomes a collusion suit or a friendly suit.
I think subsection one, Mark, that you didn't refer to is the key, though, to differentiating it. Because this is talking about the type of situation in which the legal issue is substantial and uncertain, and the initiative of pregnancy, in any event, rests with the board. So the board has determined already that it's in the public interest. It's determined to that, but it's a tough, close issue. And secondly, it's in the public interest to have it determined. And under those circumstances, I don't find that the collusive suit type of situation. That's not
that. What's your label?
I'm really not very happy about it either, but the only way to follow my advice is to take it to the local favor, but is that the state has determined that there's an effective for a test case. And they don't want to inflict undue economic strain on any particular person and resolve inflation, which is really for the benefit of the state. And on that basis alone, I would vote for the bill.
Further discussion on the motion to adopt the amendment. What's the figure of the limitations of the total?
As originally stated, it said up to $50,000 in cases that go to the appeal of the Supreme Court. Now, it's been restated. It's unclear to me whether it's $50,000 upon initial filing, or do they have to appeal it straight up?
It's up to $50,000. How far they think it is their option. But they said the reasonable fees, they can't just, bring it by the pump. $50,000 into a demur, that would, I think, be unreasonable, and the court would go with the
cost of the fees?
I didn't know.
It should be the
court. It should be
the court. So, your initial amendment is that a $50,000 fee in a rule award is a court movement and a case.
And
that's going to cost you. What do you think
that's going to remember? It's a cost.
Well, I think that the Representative Rutherford probably hit my point.
Okay. Objection, remember?
Objection.
Okay. Representative Rutherford and the Governor object. Maybe the discussion of the bill is remembered.
The recommendation.
The motion and the bill is amended.
Motion passed.
This amendment being drug.
Any discussion? This is
John. Mm-hmm.
I would hope that encompassing this amendment would be, this motion would be discretion on the part of council, which has not been through legislative council to be able to go over it and conform it to form style and whatever else might be necessary.
Correct. The question is on the motion to send the bill to the floor. As amended, new growth and a good pass recommendation.
Chairman, I would like to disclaim a conflict of interest as I may be the recipient of a test case. Thank you.
Are you disclaiming it or announcing
it?
Both of you.
Well, I'm not disclaiming the record. It's laying on it.
Please, not disclaiming it. Close the call in the roll.
Daniel.
Aye.
Summer.
Aye.
Sandowski.
Aye. I always like a roll when you do.
Aye.
Rutherford.
Aye.
Gardner.
No.
Myers.
No. Rules 5,
and
6, excuse me. Okay, that's it.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman,
if Representative Rogers,
I'm going to make this deal. Yeah,
Mr. Rogers,
your
phone
number. Are you going to
accept the letter?
I'll do that, please. Mr. Chairman, it will be a 1:30 Monday. Have a nice weekend.